This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. My guest today, painter Eric Fischel, became known in the 1980s art scene for work that explores issues of sexuality and power and what it means to become a man. In Bad Boy, which Fischel describes as his most famous and notorious painting, there is a naked woman lying on a bed. A young boy is standing in front of her, his hands behind his back, seeming to be taking something from her purse. The complexity of his early pieces can be attributed, Fischel has acknowledged, to his childhood. He grew up in the privileged country club culture of Long Island, to be specific, the Port Washington Yacht Club. But his mother suffered from depression and alcoholism and committed suicide when Fischel was 22. After decades of living in New York City, he and his wife, painter April Gornick, now live full-time in eastern Long Island. In his recent autobiography, Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas, Fischel details his youth, the art world, his own struggles with depression and substance abuse, and his thoughts about the creative process. For Eric Fischel, the book challenged him in unexpected ways.
The difficult part of writing it wasn't the early stuff where it was about family traumas and the sort of dealing with that. That was actually the easiest part to write because I put that into my paintings and stuff. So I'd already kind of gone through the emotional ramifications. What was difficult was actually trying to find some perspective in the present moment as to what my feelings were, what was going on in the world around me at that time. I went through a lot more confused feelings about the present. In the past, I dealt with it so much in the work that I knew exactly what I felt. It was just a matter of putting it into words.
Eric Fischel first picked up a paintbrush in college, an experience he describes as an awakening. Fischel was in the first undergraduate class at Cal Arts, a place that would become known as much for orgies as conceptual art. It would be some time before his skill, talent, and voice found a home in realism.
I started out being trained as an abstract painter. You know, if you were going to be a painter, you should be an abstract painter. So I tried. What it turned out was that every abstract painting I made felt like it was absolutely the last painting I could make. Then at some point, I started to work with figures and with narrative and language and stuff like that, and it flowed. That's when I realized I was now doing the work that I was supposed to do, that I was built for. And then it was a matter of getting better at it and, you know, perfecting it, honing it, et cetera.
And what was among the first things that led you to that? Like, what was the story? What was the narrative you thought, I want to put that on canvas somehow?
It was a process, actually. The process was that I found this transparent paper called glassine paper. It's this kind of paper they use to put chocolates in and stuff. It accepts oil paint beautifully. That is, the brush feels great gliding across a slick surface. If you make a mistake, you wipe it off. Very little shows of that, you know. And it's got this transparency. So I would start with an image, a chair. And I would paint a chair on this paper, and I'd stick it on the wall. And then I would sit and look at it, and I'd say, okay, where is this chair? Is it in the living room? Is it in the dining room? Is there anyone sitting in the chair? And as I was thinking that, I'd go get another transparent piece of paper, lay it on top, and say, okay, it's a person, and they're sitting this way in the chair. No, that didn't work. Take that off. Get another one. Put that on. Okay, they're actually standing next to the chair. So I would paint that. I would just talk to myself. And as I did, I would sort of create these images. And eventually a scene would emerge that seemed to resonate for me, that had some kind of memory to it, some kind of feeling in it that was expressing something about relationships between people, families, inter-family relationships, people and objects that they surround themselves with. And then, eventually I decided I wanted to actually bring that into the painting world and with color and canvas and stuff like that and more detail, more specific detail. And so it evolved into the work that I do now.
There's a description in the book about how It was the first time you were comfortable being alone when you had those tools and the material in front of you, which I found fascinating. Was there ever a thought of you doing something else creatively?
Well, music was out of the question because I have a tone-deaf ear, so there was no way I could do that.
That's a problem.
I was in a play in eighth grade in which it was called It's Cold in Them Thar Hills.
Yeah.
And I played this hillbilly named Zeke, who didn't speak through the entire play but was on stage the entire time until the very end when I had this, like, big speech where I proclaimed my love for this person who didn't know I was even present.
Do you get the girl?
And I get the girl.
Oh.
But it was like spending a lot of time kind of being present and absent at the same time was actually a profound experience for me. But it didn't lead to me wanting to do the next play or to do that. And I've actually become much more of a public person over the years. I was much more reticent, much more behind my eyes, which is really where the painter comes from. And it was a lot easier for me to, in private, have my thoughts and feelings and sort of express them before anyone ever saw them. And so I could actually control the form of expression before it entered the world.
So painting gave you art and privacy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
But that changed.
But my sensibility is very much, I think, consistent with, you know, an actor's sensibility and a director's sensibility in that sense of, you know, understanding what a dramatic moment actually is, where meaning is present and how it comes through not just a language, but it comes through a body language. It comes through a light source. It comes through a clearly defined space and how one sort of negotiates that space. And those are the things that I'm most compelled with. And in fact, my greatest pleasure is when people in the dramatic arts connect to my work, because I feel like, you know, they get it in a way that you know, other painters don't necessarily.
You do expect the images at some point to start moving. Sometimes.
To move, yeah.
Or speaking.
Yeah. And, you know, I my work is based on, or that as a source material, photographs. What photography showed me, because it slices life so thinly, it showed me that everybody is in constant motion. And that everybody is off balance, and that animates a scene. You know, it's one of the reasons I don't actually bring models into the studio and have them pose for me, because they become a static pose. When what I'm looking for is something that triggers a feeling or a memory or a provocation of some kind, and I find that where you look at a photograph that you took of somebody that is, you know, just slightly turning, so shifting weight in their body, doing something like that, that really sets those questions.
What I love when I look at photographs, when I look at paintings, when I look at your paintings, when I look at films I like, and the visual, because I went to an acting school where they said, watch the movie with the sound off.
Hmm.
And if you can't convey something, if the picture isn't telling the story 60, 75% of the time, then the movie's a
Something's
failure.
Wrong, yeah. I mean, the difference between film and theater and painting is that in both film and theater, you build an emotional sort of construct. You build a narrative construct over a set period of time with various scenes that lead to it. With painting, you're trying to shrink it down into this one moment that, when you stop that action, is when it actually begins to spin the mood, spin the moment, spin the thoughts and projections and stuff. So it's about trying to find, okay, where do I stop the action, right? For me, you stop it at something just before something happens, or just right after something happens. That if you stop it in the middle of something happening, what you end up with is a kind of confusion that doesn't take you anywhere. But if you stop before, The audience rushes in to complete it. They know where it's going now. They oh, that person's doing this, and that's going to happen because they just blah, blah, blah. Or if right after, you know, dealing with the emotional aftermath of that, then it's the audience again rushes in with the memory of those feelings that they associate with what just happened. That I find to be the real challenge and the fun part of it as well.
You know, a painter, and this is my view, this is not, I'm not saying this is a commonly held view, but this is my view, and that is that the work I do, A, it requires an audience.
Mm-hmm. And also somebody giving you a role.
Right, and someone, and so, exactly, yeah. And someone, unless you're self-producing. Yeah. But for you, my view of it is I'd sit there with and look at painters and I think, God, how much I envy them that you sit in a room and you're totally self-generating, and you do exactly what you want to do, and then you send it out into the world and say, if you like it, great. If you don't, I really don't give a shit. You know, it's completely unself-conscious in that way, unless you're doing a commission. You know what I mean? Yeah. And do you feel that way?
I don't give a shit is a protective
is it?
response. I think it's like, God, I hope they like this.
You do.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but you know, you've already done it. You accept that it may fall short of your hope and expectations. But I don't believe any painter sitting there pretending that they only do the work for themselves and stuff. They're seeking some kind of resonance, some response. Yeah.
Have you ever done a painting and you were mistaken? Meaning you did a painting. And I'm being very melodramatic here, but you did a painting and you were done and you said, good God, Fischl, you've done it. There it is. There you have it. And a painting did not succeed in one term. And then other times you sat there and said the opposite. This is a piece of crap and it was one of your most successful paintings. Has that happened?
Not in the extreme.
Right.
But I've certainly done paintings that I thought were better than they were received. And I've certainly had the experience where I've seen paintings that I didn't think were so good when I did them and see them 10 years later and go, you know, that actually isn't that bad. So I don't know. But this is a little off the subject, but more back to sort of acting and painting. I did a project once where I actually used actors. I was given a house, a Mies van der Rohe house in Krefeld, Germany, to do some kind of interaction with the house. I never worked with actors before. And so I went to friends who were in the business, you know, writers, playwrights, screenwriters, whatever, directors, to give me some ideas, like, how do you talk to an actor? What gets them going, et cetera? Because I had no clue. And the simplest advice came back from Mike Nichols, who said, oh, give them problems. They love problems. And I says, what the hell's a problem? They said, oh, you know, she wants to borrow $500 from him, but you won't tell him why. Why just give him that? You'll see,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I was like, okay. So I went into this thing with these two actors who happened to be German. They understood English, but they performed and, you know, they did whatever they did in
what
German.
What a funny thing for him to choose.
I know. I know, and that's strange. And I was taking still photographs, too. I was just clicking snapshots. I wasn't recording it. I didn't think I cared about, you know, the dialogue. I didn't care about the, you know, sound, etc., whatever. All I wanted were these sort of still moments. What blew my mind was that I would give them a problem. And I was surprised at how fast I could tell that the problem I gave them wasn't any good. They couldn't get animated. And they were just like...
It wasn't achieving the desired effect.
No, they were just dead. It was like nothing. Their body couldn't even move hardly. So, and at the same time, when I gave them something they could really bite their teeth into...
For example...
Well, I did a...
She'll sleep with you, but she has to break up with her boyfriend first.
Yeah. The thing is, the female actress had like zero interest in him, but she was very professional, and so we're going to do the bedroom stuff. And I set up some stuff in there, and it really wasn't working. It was, you know... There was something, they were dressed in evening clothes, it was late to come home, you know, he's drunk, she's hoping that, you know, they could have some sex, maybe he's, you know, what it can't kind of get it together. It was lame. So he gets up and he goes off to the bathroom or something like that. And so I say to her, look, take off your clothes and get in the bed. You're a wild animal. Whatever you do, don't let him in the bed. Now, this bed that I had chosen was like a modernist bed that had this igloo of a mosquito netting over it. So it made like a cocoon or something like that, a tent. So I said, whatever you do, don't let him in the bed, right? But you're a wild animal. All of a sudden, she like curls up into this incredible kind of creature and like pushes herself against the end of the wall and is like just sitting there waiting, right? And he comes back into the room, and now he sees her in the bed. She's naked. It's like, oh.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Now we're getting somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And he takes his bathrobe off and walks over to the netting. He starts to lift it up, and she comes flying across the bed, one leap, and smashes him in the face, right? And he's like, whoa. And then he goes, whoa. This could be fun.
I like the women challenge.
Yeah. And I'm like going, oh, no.
And you got good images.
I got great images also that. Yeah. Yeah. They did a whole dance around getting in and out of the bed. And when he finally got in, she slipped out and, you know, reversed the roles and stuff. And that was that. But
no, with people that you photograph, manipulate, paint, whatever verb you want to use for the work you do and the stages of the work you do, how much of would you say your view of people, because I think like most men, we have this in common, which is this kind of relationship of your mother.
Hmm.
And if you have a good relationship with your mother, let's say you want to replicate that. If you have a terrible relationship with your mother, you want to find someone who's the opposite of your mother.
Right.
Or you want to restage the drama with your mother. Right. As a therapist once said to me, we want to restage that in our lives, and you get all the good lines now, which eluded you in your youth. So
I think all art expression is in some way trying to correct a lot of stuff.
And for
you
how
trying
so?
To put some clarity to it, some order to it, make it make sense, you know.
Well, how would you think that you're very candid about your mother, who is obviously very ill. You know, she's mm-hmm. a very sick woman, mm-hmm. And that plays out in her behavior. She wasn't a mean-spirited woman.
No.
She was just completely overwhelmed
just out
by
of
alcohol.
Control. Yeah.
How would you say that colored, because count to three when you read the book and you're bell bottoms and Haight Ashbury and you're into a very kind of summer of love. 66, I think, is when you head mm-hmm. out to the West Coast and you're in the thick of it. How do you think, what did you carry out there with you in terms of your idea about women and what you wanted? Or because what I get from the book is you're someone who was kind of raised not to ask for anything.
Well, I had, you know, sort of two kinds of relationships with women. One was I was attracted to women that were absolutely bad for me. They opened up that void, you know, just emptiness that in a way that was like
replaying that feeling.
Yeah. And, it, you know, it was full of passion and it was full of, you know, this, you know, profound need and stuff like that. It was very emotional and very short lived. And then the other kind of woman was one where, you know, they were really stable.
Reliable.
And reliable. And
available.
Yeah. And I married them.
Right. You're married to April?
I married them. I was married once before.
You were married once before.
And
stable.
And stable enough, yeah. But then, I married April and, you know, for the last 30-some-odd years, yeah.
Did your work change in sync with your attitude toward love and relationships?
It did with time. You know, the early relationship with April, for example, we were both young artists really trying to find our voices, trying to understand who we were. I was dealing with the wounds of the past as opposed to the, you know, the present with her. So it wasn't apparent then, other than the stability of our relationship gave me the courage to look into these other areas.
How was she different?
Well, you know, she's incredibly bright and incredibly disciplined and She's somebody that can multitask in an emotional way.
Do you have children?
No.
Do you think that was partly because of what your childhood?
Yeah,
really?
I think both April and I had a lot very traumatic things that passed that made that seem dangerous.
Do you regret having not done that? Because you have a very warm, humanistic, your personality.
Yeah.
No,
there was a point at which I felt like I could handle having kids, but April wasn't there yet.
Right.
And the one thing I wasn't going to do was insist that we do it my way because I knew what
she was only going to indulge you so far.
Yeah, right. or it was going to break her down in a way that I couldn't bear. So, you know, it passed.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, your father, he went that route that a lot of dads go, which is he just wants to give you the safe advice.
Yeah.
His parental duty was to say to you, you know, let's be reasonable now.
Right.
And he told you to go to get into business. Did your father live to see you become a great success?
He did, yeah. My mother didn't. My father did. He actually didn't understand what success was in art anyway. He'd kind of given up by then, right? So
Understanding you.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So you had a very, very kind of icy relationship with him.
It was volatile and complicated. But, you know, he really didn't know anything about art, so he didn't really know anything about what success in art was. And back then, you know, success and fortune were not connected to each other in the art world. You could be highly successful, you know, shown in museums around the world and still be doing a teaching job or driving a taxi or something to do it. So he was perplexed that I would even be in a field in which there wasn't a monetary reward necessarily, right? But at some point, he started to see my name in print. And that was something that he understood as success. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden, a local newspaper or, you know, an art magazine or something, there's his son, right? And then he really flipped from sort of disengagement to the proud parent who,
yeah,
you know, we'd go into a grocery store and at the checkout counter, he'd go, you know who this is? My son. This is the artist.
Da-da. He'd take the clipping out of his wallet.
Yeah, exactly.
This is from the New York Times. That's ERICFISCHL. Just, you know, no EL.
No E.
No E.
Well, you know, he became an artist at the end of his life as well. He discovered collage, and it took him a while after he retired to find. He tried other things, and then all of a sudden, he found himself like sitting in his office at home, cutting pictures out and gluing them together. And you know, he was not a schooled artist, but he had an eye and he had a kind of liveliness to these collages that he made that were very expressive. And by the time he died, I had realized that he and I could never talk to each other. We just kept missing, you know. But we understood each other visually. And so he would send me his collages, and I knew exactly what he was thinking about, where he was at, how he was feeling. You know, he was really communicating through these visual images. And he showed me that he had been using my paintings to understand what had happened in our lives with my mother and the whole family dynamic. And so we actually were both visual people who understood what that meant to communicate visually to each other. So it was deeply rewarding to me ultimately, but it took me a while to understand that.
Did he ever talk to you about your paintings and his view of your paintings?
Well, at first, I mean, he talked to me about success, you know, you could see and be enthusiastic for this show and that show, et cetera, et cetera. But there was this thing that happened that was, I think, really blew my mind, which was that I had done a painting called A Woman Possessed. And it was a painting of a woman outside their suburban home, drunk, passed out in the driveway, surrounded by these dogs that were like, you know, beasts from hell. That were, you know, some were sniffing her, some were growling at the son who had just come home from school. The school books are on the ground. His bicycle's flipped over. He'd hopped off his bike. So this boy is trying to pull her away from these dogs and her demon dogs. I showed the painting in Toronto, and the critic described it in the most beautiful terms. He understood it as a painting that revealed the profound pain of love, of loving someone, right? And it was a painting. It was the only painting in this show. It was a one painting show. And he wrote extensively about it. And so, you know, proud son sends it to my father. And unbeknownst to me, my father sends the review off to my siblings, right? And my younger sister, Lori, writes back a letter to him. She's furious. Why is he trying to make her remember this painful time, you know? And he shared these letters to me. I didn't know they were having until the whole communication came to me. But he shared to me her response and then his response to her, in which he revealed that he had been actually using my paintings the whole time to understand emotionally what had been happening in our lives and stuff, and that he was just trying to heal something, you know, trying to bring her into it as well, and to into a kind of healing process,
and to acknowledge his awareness.
Yeah. Which took me completely by surprise, and that he had been seeing the work as deeply as he had, you know, revealed
as you intended
letter,
it to be seen,
which is what I intended,
which
and hoped for.
He might have been last on a list of people to have gotten it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Did he find his April and marry someone that was reliable for him emotionally?
No. I mean, he married somebody that was absolutely reliable, loved him, you know, stable. It's a, yes, in that sense. But she was such a polar opposite of my mother. I was surprised because I thought my father would just find some little bit more you know, manageable version of my mother, the things that he loved in my mother, her creativity, her
but
her
who had triumphed over her alcoholism, her demons.
Yeah. Yeah. But instead, he wasn't attached to that part of her. So,
Coming up in part two of our conversation, Eric Fischel talks about the challenges of becoming a first-time art teacher.
I was only a couple of years older than them to begin with.
Sure, you're a young teacher.
And I had never been taught techniques.
And the benefits. That's where he met his current wife, April. This is Alec Baldwin. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. My guest today is Eric Fischel. For years, he and his wife worked out of their downtown Manhattan studio. But he says the city doesn't feed him like it once did. Now he feels a greater connection to nature. Back in the early 80s, however, it was the perfect place to develop his craft.
Soho was percolating. I mean, it was a real village of artists. You know,
It wasn't Lower Madison Avenue like it is now.
No, it was not a mall. It was a village, and you know, kind of thing where you would see people you knew on the streets every day. You'd sit and talk. You'd break bread and hang out at art bars and stuff like that. It was great, and there was a kind of exciting tension between the older artists and us young kids who had come there to make a difference, and there was a rivalry and a kind of healthy competitive thing going on. We wanted to kill them, and they wanted to ignore us.
By them, who do you mean particularly?
Well, there was a generation of artists, half a generation, 5-10 years older.
For example?
That were doing sort of minimalist work. For example, people like Don Judd or Carl Andre or Saul LeWitt. There were conceptual artists like Larry Wiener or Joseph Kossuth or, you know, to name a couple, that were doing a whole different kind of thing. Painting had become a disregarded medium. So part of my generation was trying to see if we could reassert some kind of authority and authenticity to painting. And the kind of painting that the minimalists had done had brought painting to its ultimate conclusion, which was to essentially have a kind of nothing there. A lot of artists felt it was a dead medium. And then there were other artists like myself who was absolutely, no, the painting's real, and, you know, you just have to find the truth, find the, you know, the things that matter and convey them convincingly. There wasn't yet the limos, there wasn't yet the kind of rock star status. All those things were to come.
When?
Probably by 85, it started to happen.
And how would you describe that? When it came, how? People weren't collecting. You talk about painting was an overlooked medium art form. We read about the art world where, you know, dead masters continue to sell paintings for tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And at that time in the late 70s and 80s, is that what the art collecting world was confined to? Were the masters of art and everything contemporary was just overlooked?
No, what it was there was a...
Warhol wasn't Warhol then, was he?
He wasn't in terms of financially, he wasn't. His paintings were still selling pretty cheaply. But a collector base entered that had made money very quickly in the dot-com world and then moved into sort of buying art and speculating on it. There was a sense that the object was to find the next genius, right? So what you did was you started to speculate on young artists, buying a lot of it cheap, hoping that one of them was going to turn out to be Picasso or something like that. There were all these stories that, you know, a collector buying a Jasper Johns painting for $250 and, you know, selling it for $11 million.
Yeah. Johns giving it to you to pay his rent or one of those stories.
Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. So there was like this whole sort of kind of vogue among collectors to just go in and put money into young artists.
Speculatively.
Yeah. And, you know, it was a way for them to deal with their money anyway because they had more
and
that than
changed
they
the art world.
Now it's hedge funders and stuff.
I have a guy who's a friend of mine who's an artist. Mm-hmm. And then one guy will say to me, hey, man. And he says it, you know, without an ounce of cynicism. Go online and look at Kevin Johnson. I'll make up a name. Go see Kevin Johnson. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Johnson has just a white canvas. It's just white. He's like, no, you don't get it, man. He's like, this guy, he's white. This is what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Everyone's just digging on Kevin Johnson's. This isn't white. It's Kevin Johnson's white. It's Kevin Johnson's white. Everyone's just jonesing for this white. Yeah. You're going to buy this now for $150,000, and about 5 years from now, you're going to sell it for $500,000, maybe $1 million. I mean, everyone's going nuts for Kevin Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I'd look at paintings. I thought to myself, oh, that's just a game I didn't want to play. But people are playing that game constantly.
Yeah, I don't understand why people don't have a space in their life where they don't do what they normally do. You know, like if you're a hedge funder or some financial guy, why do you have to turn everything into a transaction? Why do you have to monetize it? Why isn't there this one place where you do something just for yourself?
But how do you feel knowing that you're going to do a painting and that painting is done? And you sit there and say, now this painting may wind up like in an apartment at 15 Central Park West. Mm-hmm. Some guy's just going to punt it to another guy and another guy. And you just don't even have any feeling about that? You just accept that? Or does it piss you off?
Yeah. Well, it completely pisses me off. It's the kind of thing that if I actually let it get into my studio, it'll destroy why I make art.
You block that out.
And obviously it gets increasingly harder and harder to do that. I mean, I do these works on paper, that oil on paper. They're sketches. They're a great pleasure for me to do. Some of them lead to painting. Some of them don't. But it's an activity that I do. And there was a time when they would be sold, you know, for like $5,000 and then, you know, $10,000. And I, at some point on the secondary market, they were selling for $100,000. You know, I would sell it to, you know, in a show for $5,000. 6 months later, they're in an auction someplace for $100,000, right? So you go back into the studio and you're, you know, I'm making my sketches and stuff like that. And I'm looking at it thinking, well, why not do a couple more, you know? Why not, you know, it's like all of a sudden they're starting to turn into currency, you know, and which is a totally different sort of way of thinking about
it. And how
right?
much, and how hard is it for you to resist? Because I was joking with a friend of mine last night over dinner. And I said, what it must be like in your world where you're completely self-determining, where you're completely self-generating. I get kind of amazed. I sit there and say, God, Eric Fischel's the kind of guy where if he and April are like laying there in bed on Sunday, I mean, I have a very kind of a silly improv comedy view of it. April Gornick and Eric Fischel are lying in bed on a Sunday reading the New York Times, and she turns to him and goes, Eric, I'd so love to go hella skiing. You're reading the papers November. I'd so love to go hella skiing in British Columbia in January. And you're like, sure, baby. Let's go hella. And you go out and you paint a painting.
The
and that's
hella
the hella skiing
painting.
Trip.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you can just go do a painting. You're Eric Fischel and run it out the door, whether you like it. Like how hard is it for you to resist that?
I used to have this fantasy that when my muse left me, I would still be able to make product, right? That I wouldn't be making art anymore, but I'd be making things that look like art and that was okay, right? And so there were times in my process where I got stuck. The inspiration was gone and I was sure that it now, you know, my muse, my inspiration had left, right? A total blockage kind of thing. And what I found to my horror was that it didn't just leave my head, it left my hand, and that I actually couldn't paint anymore. I couldn't draw. I couldn't make something look like something. It literally left every part of it.
I feel the
right?
same way. Yeah. I couldn't talk.
And that was terrifying, right? That's like your worst nightmare. And so I have that memory, which keeps me somewhat, you know, focused on staying true to my ultimate goal.
So you're there and you're in that space and the muse isn't there for you and you've decided not to engage, preferably, if you don't. So what's the longest period you went that you didn't paint?
It's not so much that I didn't paint. I kept trying, like a bulldog when it comes. I just, you know, keep trying to go through it. It's just it's dead, dead, dead. So I try to keep in mind that there's like two audiences and there's only one audience that's actually worth playing to. And it's an audience of voices that are in your head, that are made up of heroes, you know, artists I admire.
Such as?
Well, you know, there's historical figures that like, you know, the greatest, you know, arm sculptor, you know, Michelangelo, say, the greatest sort of anger painter, Max Beckmann. You know, they have very particular things for me that I admire, that I either emulate or can't do and wish I could, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But they're clarifying. And there, you know, there's the mother voice, the father voice, the gym teacher voice, the, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm.
And a chorus.
Yeah. And they're all in there sort of saying what I can and can't do, what I should and shouldn't do, et cetera. And so I'm like, each painting is sort of proving to these voices that this was the right move, you know, that I was going to do something that they would admire, something that would finally shut them up, finally, you know, whatever. anyway, this is an audience of that is stands outside of time. It's constant and it has a quality standard to it that I understand. You know, I can tell when my paintings are falling short of that performance, that, you know, it didn't reach where I needed it to go, because I knew that I was falling short of this person I admire, this person that I hate.
Insofar as your own paintings, through your success, are monetized, mm-hmm. Or just collected by pure collectors and or hang in institutions, have you yourself collected others' paintings? Have you used your success? Whose art hangs in your home?
Yeah,
have you collected art?
I have. I don't consider myself a collector at all. What I did was, at a certain point, I wanted to acknowledge my peers. So I wanted to collect something of each of the people that I admire, who you know, have inspired me, supported me, you know, whatever, helped me form my thoughts. So, you know, I have examples of their work. That's why I'm not a collector. It's because I don't have the connoisseurship in terms of going after the best David Sally painting, the best Cindy Sherman, the best Anselm Kiefer, you know, things like that. What I have is examples of their work that somebody looking over my shoulder would say, oh, this was your time and these were your people and stuff.
And what about your own work? Have you finished a painting and you said, that's for me?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's
and the older
hangs.
I get, the more I do that. Yeah,
I'll keep this one.
Early on, I couldn't afford it, and you know, let some of my best work go
fly out the window.
Yeah, exactly. Now I'm a little bit more precious about that, and part of it is the, you know, the love doesn't come back in the way you need it to come back. The exchange is not. You know, it doesn't really work in the way you want it to, which is to say, I make a painting out of love, right? And a profound love, which includes respect, admiration, desire, need, you know, all of the things that go into, you know, being a human, wanting to communicate to another human and connect to another human. I call that love, and so I make a painting out of love, and I'm seeking love in return. I want that to come back in that way, right? So somebody gives you money, right? Which, on one hand, you think, well, that's an expression of love. They want to possess your work, so they're expressing love. But money doesn't feel like love because it's a neutral currency. Now, I have to change that money into something that tells me how much love I just got back, right?
How do you do that?
Exactly. That's where the issue is. How do you do that?
You know, how have you done it?
Well, so you buy a car or you buy a house. You buy...
Add on to your house.
Yeah, exactly. You do things that you want / need. You do that, and then there's a point at which you don't need those things anymore. Right. You've got all your toys and stuff.
Your mortgage is paid.
Exactly. But now you have excess,
yeah.
Right? So is that excess love, or is that just...
but my question for you is, when the muse goes away, when you lapse into a period of product versus art, mm-hmm. when the artist, and that's a very real condition, struggles... I found people where it affects them in many ways. It affects their appetite, mm-hmm. their sexual appetite, their physical health, their emotional health, sure. their sleep. I mean, it really, really, really damages them and hurts them. Have you gone through periods of that where you were like mm-hmm. really, really thought you were losing it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
What'd you do to get out of it?
I
painted your way out of it?
Ultimately painted the way out of it, but, you know, relied a lot on April to, you know, keep me sort of above
so you bring the me water to where, and stuff. So you bring me to where the one of our last two questions is.
Yeah.
Let's go to Halifax and you meet April. And where are you at your life when you meet April, and what happened?
I'm 27 years old or something like that. I'm teaching at this art school that actually is a very sort of advanced thinking place that, like Cal Arts, where I went to school, Nova Scotia College of Art and Design was also sort of based on the most radical art of the moment, anti-painting. So they hired me as a young, untested painter, teacher, simply because they'd fired somebody mid-semester, needed someone right away. They could care less about painting, so they took a risk on this guy based on what my former teacher had recommended. I get this job. I'm in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I go up there with my wife at the time, spend 3 months teaching there, she lapsing into a deep depression because she's rootless and being ignored. And I'm
following you, basically.
Yeah, and following me, and I'm not sensitive enough to it, you know, what that sacrifice was. And, you know, we moved back to Chicago in the summer, and I get rehired, and she announces she doesn't want to go back, and our marriage is over. And that following year, I meet April. I didn't plan on falling in love. I just planned on having sex. And
shame on you, Eric.
I know.
Shame on you.
Call me shallow.
Shallow. You know? So shallow.
Anyway, one thing led to another. And what it was I was actually going through a very sort of complicated set of emotions for, you know, I had never mourned the death of my mother. I had just broken up with, you know, split with my wife kind of thing. I was now falling in love, not wanting to, with April. My work was going through a transition where I was giving up the artist I thought I was going to be for the artist I ultimately became. And that period of doubt threw me into a kind of series of, you know, anxiety attacks, panic modes, where I really began to have some serious psychological issues. I was dissociating and, you know, ended up on, you know, antipsychotic medicine and stuff like that to stabilize me. Meanwhile, I'm teaching.
Meanwhile, you're up showing these young, impressionable minds the world through your eyes.
Exactly.
Let me show you the world through my clonopin-soaked eyes.
And the thing is that I was only a couple of years older than them to begin with.
Sure. You're a young teacher.
And I had never been taught technique. So I'm teaching
the orgy thing like your teacher were doing at Cal Arts? Or had that day come and gone?
That day had come and gone.
Okay, great. I'm glad to hear that. So go ahead.
You know, right. To some extent. I was definitely going through several women in the student body, but not all at the same moment. But right.
It was a sacrifice. You mean,
yeah, right? I mean, it's a small, isolated community. The winters are harsh up there.
It's Gilligan's Island.
Yeah,
and when the skipper runs into Ginger and Marianne, we can only talk about the weather for so many times.
Yeah, exactly.
And the tidal charts. So go ahead. So the skipper runs into Ginger and Marianne.
Yeah, and ultimately ran into April, and she stuck with me through this time, which was, you know, really difficult, and in a kind of way that, you know, I just couldn't imagine there being anybody else. So we did. Now, she was a student who started out doing very conceptual art. I actually, the way I tried to impress on her to make her look at me was I found her working on a project she was doing, something that had, she was gluing pieces of wood to a piece of paper and then writing some obscure philosophical text around it. And it was, you know, I just went up to her and said, you know, the idea of gluing wood onto paper just seemed a redundancy that was so stupid. I can't imagine why anyone would do it. Thinking that she'd want to have dinner with me, having said that. And she just told me to go fuck myself, and that was that. And then for the next 6 months, I tried to make nice to sort of—
To recover.
To recover.
from your offense.
And so I don't know what made me think an insult would be the way to open the door.
Did she ever return the favor?
It did work, I guess.
Oh, it did.
So, yeah.
Did she ever return the favor? Did she ever walk into your studio and say, "What were you thinking?"
Yeah.
This is just.
Yeah, no, she's actually my greatest, most clear-seen critic.
Is she your most prevalent subject? Have you painted her more than any other person?
Yes.
You have?
Yeah. I've painted her a lot. I've painted her in disguised ways, and I've painted her in ways where you can see it's her.
So now you are a very well-known man, and your work is very popular. You and your wife are a very admired couple in a community that you live in. And I want to ask you, why do you live out here particularly? You could escape, like a lot of great artists find. They want to have real anonymity and peace. You could go live in Italy or anywhere you want to go. Why here? And also, let's be honest, we live out here and there are certain social rhythms out here and there are certain patterns that repeat themselves almost metronomically out here all the time. Mm-hmm. And do you find in a strange way you've washed up on the shores of your own Port Washington Yacht Club in a way? I mean, is there kind of a rigor to the way you're living now that you didn't bargain for?
Yeah, I think there was a moment a while back where I kind of looked around and went, oh my God, this is where I grew up. I'm in a different relationship to it, but it's definitely, more of a suburban than an urban environment and a suburban kind of rhythm to it. But everybody needs a sense of community, needs a sense of place, where they belong, right? I grew up on Long Island. You grew up on Long Island. I used to come out here in the summertime. It's familiar territory, et cetera. It seems natural in a way to want to be here. And also there's a scale to it that makes you think that you can make a difference. It seems like pretty much everywhere you go, we're in a state of, transformation or decay or something where it's going to take 10 years before this place gets ruined. You go to someplace else, it's going to take another 5 years before that one does. So you think, okay, I'll stay and fight it a little bit and do that. Plus on some, sort of basic level, you actually feel like you belong here.
Right.
So you want it to.
It's mine.
To do it.
It's mine.
Other people's and it's mine.
Yeah. Well, so is it safe to say, just to conclude this, if you will, the eponymous bad boy of the title still has his doubts, still has his anxiety, still has his fears and issues and so forth. He just has learned to handle them differently.
I think that's true. Yeah, absolutely. They don't go away. I thought that the older you got, the easier it got. Yeah. It turns out the opposite.
Yeah. We just learn how to manage it better.
You just manage it, yeah. Yeah, no, it's true.
Eric Fischel says he didn't set out to write a memoir. His friend Michael Stone was writing about Cal Arts, which then morphed into their book, Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas. This is Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing, comes from WNYC Radio.